Good afternoon and welcome to On the Arts, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today you're in for a treat. You'll be talking with a supreme. Sherry Payne of the Supremes is talking with Sheho Letswallow of KLW. She's appearing with friends at Marin Jazz for some holiday cheer this Friday. Kung Pao Kosher Comedy is celebrating its 32nd year of Jewish comedy on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant. I'll talk with creator and comedian Lisa Geduldig and one of the artists in this year's lineup, comedian Matt Kirshen. Steve Indig, also known as DJ Shindog, tells us about a couple of non-holiday events coming up, including the 2025 edition of the David Bowie Elvis Bash. And I'll talk with conductor Martin West about this year's presentation of the San Francisco Ballet's beautiful production of Nutcracker. All coming up after a news update from the BBC. Stay with us.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. The de facto leader of Syria, Ahmed al-Sharaa, has said the country is exhausted by war and is not a threat to its neighbours or to the West. In his first formal interview since his forces toppled President Assad and took control in Damascus, he told the BBC that sanctions on Syria should be lifted. He also said that he'd keep his promises to respect the rights of sectarian groups and minorities.
The Syrian population has lived together for thousands of years. We're going to discuss all of it. We're going to have dialogue and make sure everyone is represented. The old regime always played on sectarian divisions, but we won't. We were welcomed in all the big cities by all the sects. I think the revolution can contain everybody.
An Indian Navy speedboat has lost control and struck a passenger ferry in Mumbai Harbour, causing it to capsize. 13 people were killed, including 10 civilians and 3 Navy personnel. Eletra Naismith has more details.
The packed ferry was making its way to the Elephanta Caves, a popular tourist destination, when it was hit by the speedboat. Video footage shows the vessel circling before it heads straight for the passenger boat, colliding head-on. The Navy, Coast Guard and Marine Police launched an immediate search and rescue operation as passengers desperately tried to escape the ferry. It's thought more than 80 people were on board. Navy personnel are among those killed. Survivors have been taken to nearby hospitals.
The Speaker of Liberia's House of Representatives is one of 4 people being questioned by police after a huge fire destroyed the Parliament building. The flames gutted both chambers of the legislature, but no one was in the building at the time. The fire occurred a day after moves by a political faction to replace Jonathan Fanati Kofa as Speaker led to protests. Brazil's Congress has been voting on austerity measures proposed by the left-wing government of President Lula da Silva. The voting comes as the local currency continues to lose value against the US dollar. Leonardo Rocha has this report.
President Lula is in a very difficult political situation. He was elected 2 years ago, promising to reduce inequality, reversing, as he put, the losses experienced by Brazilian workers during the government of his right-wing predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro. But as there are fears of public spending spiraling out of control, President Lula was forced to propose tough austerity measures, including cuts to education spending and restrictions on future rises to the minimum wage.
Nigerian officials say several children have died during a crush at a religious event at an Islamic high school in the southwestern city of Ibadan. Reports say there were over 5,000 high school pupils at the carnival, where organisers promised prizes, including scholarships. World News from the BBC. Eyewitnesses in Sudan say shelling by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces in the city of Al-Fasha has killed 10 civilians and wounded 20 others. They said the main hospital was hit, destroying wards, pharmacies and the operating theatre. The RSF targeted the same hospital last Friday, killing 9 people. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has met Donald Trump's nominee to succeed him, Marco Rubio. Mr. Rubio has been a vocal critic of President Biden's military support for the war in Ukraine, and the Trump administration is expected to soften the US stance on Russia. A spokesperson for the US State Department, Vedant Patel, said the two men had a constructive conversation.
It was a good and constructive and substantive conversation. And as we've said, as we said initially, when they first had the opportunity to speak on the phone, that we expected them to have an engagement at some point. This is consistent with that. And as we've long said, we continue to stand ready to help support a seamless transition come January 20th.
The French Prime Minister, François Bayrou, has said the overseas territory of Mayotte has suffered probably the worst natural disaster to hit France in several centuries. The Indian Ocean island was devastated by the passing of Cyclone Chido, with much of the population still without running water and power. Latvian prosecutors say they're investigating officials over delays and overspending on a new rail link between the Baltics and Poland. The opening of the Rail Baltica line, connecting Europe's high-speed rail network to the capitals of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, has been pushed back several times. It's now expected to open in 2030. In football, Real Madrid have won the Intercontinental Cup in Qatar by defeating Pachuca from Mexico 3-0. The goals were scored by Mbappe, Rodrigo and Vinicius Jr. The yearly tournament gathers the champions of each of FIFA's six confederations around the world. BBC News.
We're going to start things off in a nostalgic note with a touch of disco from a true diva and a living legend who is still on stage this Friday in Marin. Here with that segment is On the Arts, KLW's Sheha Letswala.
Thank you so much, David. Underneath us, we're listening to Free My Soul by today's guest, Sherry Payne. Thank you so much for joining me today. Sherry is a former member of the Supremes. She joined in 1973 and together with Mary Wilson and Cindy Birdsong kept the legendary girl group going after Diana Ross's departure. During that decade, the iconic Motown sound was being replaced by disco, and it was some of Payne's contributions that helped usher the Supremes into a new era, singing lead on singles like I'm Going to Let My Heart Do the Walking, which got to number 3 on the disco charts. Sherry will be performing with fellow former ladies of the Supremes, Linda Lawrence and Joyce Vincent, at Marin Jazz on Friday, December 20, at the Marin Showcase Theatre. Sherry Payne, thank you. Welcome to On the Arts.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Thank you so much.
So let's start with the former ladies of the Supremes and what folks can expect at this show, at this holiday show at Marin Jazz.
Well, lots of good music, old music, a little, maybe a couple of new things, a surprise from Joyce Vincent, you know, was a former member, an original member of Tony Orlando and Dawn, but we'll give and do some nostalgic songs, Supreme songs, and I think they're going to have a great time. It's going to be a great time, reminiscing, yay.
That sounds really lovely. Now is a good time for a little bit of nostalgia. So you were the final lead singer of the Supremes. And before that, you had a career with Glasshouse. What was it like stepping into this well-established, well-loved group for you, both emotionally and artistically? Because I feel like that would be complicated.
It was just unbelievable. Actually, I had been with the Glasshouse and we were doing pretty well, had a couple of hits like Crumbs Off the Table, so on and so forth. But then Lamont Dozier had, the late Lamont Dozier from Holland Dozier Holland, had come out to California on a business trip and ran into Mary Wilson. And she said that Gene Terrell was leaving the group and they were looking for a new lead singer. So of course he suggested me, because at that time we were dating. And so Mary called me and I sent her some Glasshouse albums and pictures, and then she called me back and said she'd loved what she saw and heard and wanted to know if I could come out to California. And that was on a Thursday evening, and I said, sure, when? She said, Saturday. I said, Saturday? She said, yeah, I got your ticket at the airport. Northwest Airlines. So when Lamont took me home that night, I said, oh my God, I told my mother, I said, that's too big. The Supremes, that's too big. And so my mother gave me that big pep talk like mothers will do. And my mother was a good pep talker too. And that Saturday morning, I got on that plane, came out to LA, and but Cindy Birdsong and her husband, at that time Charles Hewlett, picked me up, took me straight to Mary's house, and we went right into rehearsals because I didn't know they had a show the following Saturday in New Mexico at the State Fair. I'm like, dang.
So you were thrown right into it.
I was thrown right into it. And they said if I did a good job, the job was mine. I think Donnie Hathaway was the opening, or not the opening act, but one of the acts on the show. I'm trying to remember. It's like a blur now. You never have to realize how long ago that was. Wow. 73. 1983.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty incredible and iconic to me that you were with Motown and around this era. Do you have any favorite memories or moments? Because it's such a rich time for music. Oh, I think a lot of the music that we listen today is still the foundation of it is a lot of Motown. So what were some of those highlights for you?
Oh my goodness, there's so many. I can't even name just one. Just recording in the studio. I remember one time I did a background for, it was behind Marvin Gaye's song, a couple of his songs. I'm trying to remember who was with me in the booth. But of course, he's my all-time favorite singer. But there were so many things like traveling to so many countries. I never imagined I would be able to go to Japan, Australia, the UK even. Wow. And met so many wonderful, wonderful friends there who became more than just fans. They became family to me. Mm-hmm. Steve Weaver and so many, Kevin Melville and, oh my gosh, Malcolm Bocott. The list goes on and on, on and on. Jim Safin. I could just go on and on. It's just wonderful.
I mean, it was also a different time. So I'm also wondering if you had maybe challenges or experience as a woman during that time, and also being a creative woman who also wanted to contribute songwriting and maybe contribute musically. Did you ever face any challenges or any walls against that?
I'm trying to remember now. Maybe they didn't take you as seriously. I really can't remember, because it was just so glamorous. It was just so new and in of course, I was tired too, because we were working all the time. I was out of town more than I was in town. So I just had so many wonderful experiences. I can't even begin to talk about all of them.
That's good to know. I'm glad that overall it was a really magical experience for you, because it comes across definitely in your singing, in the music. And you also helped the Supremes kind of transition into this kind of disco era, because, you know, things were moving along. So do you remember the first time, or what you were thinking and feeling as you heard like your first disco song? And bonus points if you can remember what the first disco song you heard was.
I think you said, you mean that we recorded?
Yes,
that you Let My Heart Do the Walking. I'm trying to remember now. I remember I had recorded the song, and then Susay came into the group, and then she put this high note on top of it, and it just made it come more to life, I think. But I'm trying to remember the songs we recorded even before that, that were sort of semi-disco, because that was also new. And because I was used to R&B or just pop. And so this was a totally new experience. But I'm gonna Let My Heart Do the Walking. It was a wonderful song for us to come out and on, or whatever, however you wanna put it. I'm trying to remember some other songs. You know, have to realize 1973, 74, that was so long ago. My memory.
Yeah.
Spinning.
Yeah. I mean, was it intimidating thinking transitioning to disco? Did that feel scary? Or did you feel like I love this new sound? I love what is happening out in the rest of the world right now, and I want to be a part of it. Was that kind of feeling you had?
You hit the nail right on the head, because everybody was doing it. Everybody was trying to transition and to fit into that new mold and not be left behind. Because some people couldn't do it, but we were excited. We were excited about it. And ready to take that step and be adventurous. And that's what it turned out to be, a new adventure for us.
Yeah, and when you went solo, you released one of my favorite disco songs, because I'm a huge fan of the 10cc's I'm Not in Love. Oh. I love disco and dance music, and you put it together just 10 out of 10 for me. I love that song.
Thank you.
Let's take a little bit of a listen to that right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sherry Payne. We Are Dancing.
That's my all-time favorite song, too.
It's so good. I love the disco strings and the disco horns. Just the arrangement is so good. And I believe on that song, your sister was also doing backing vocals, Frida Payne. Is that correct?
Let's see. Was it Frida? Let's see. Edmund Silvers, I think. I'm trying to remember if Mary was on there. I need to look that up myself. Leon Silvers, I think. Not Leon, I'm sorry, Edmund Silvers. And I think Mary Wilson, I believe.
Oh.
And I'm trying to remember if Frida was on. I don't think Frida was on there. You don't have it on there listed?
I'm pretty sure I looked that up and she might have been on there. That's what my research says. But you do come from a musical family because your sister Frida you collaborated on, if not this song, other songs. Was growing up, was music always a really important part of your family?
Well, my mother nor our father sang. My mother couldn't even hold a note in a basket. But my father, he didn't sing either, but he had his sister sang, and they had a little gospel group down in Asheville, North Carolina. Maybe that's where we got it from, but I tell people we got it from God. And so my mother said I was singing before I was even talking or walking. I was singing in the crib or whatever. Frida was the bashful one. I was the extrovert, and she was the introvert. And then for some reason around the age of 10 and 12, the roles reversed, and Frida became the extrovert and I became the introvert. It was when our piano teacher, Ruth Johnson, told Frida one day, she asked her to sing something that she was playing, and Frida sang it. She said, well, Frida, you have a lovely voice. She said, I do? And so Frida starts singing, and I just went into a sort of a shell, I think. But even though I sang, but then shortly after that, that's when Berry Gordy discovered Frida. Actually, she was his first artist before he even had Motown.
So, nice.
We love singing. It's been in our blood. It just comes up. It's a natural gift from God. That's what I tell people.
And we are extremely blessed to be able to hear it. And folks might be able to hear it this Friday at Marin Jazz. Can you talk a little bit more about the folks that you're performing with? Because you've had a long performing relationship as it fluctuated throughout the years with Linda Lawrence and Joyce Vincent. So can you talk a little bit more about them and their performances as artists as well?
Oh, yes. Well, Linda, was in the Supremes before I was. She sang with Gene Terrell, and they both left in 73. And that's when I joined with Mary Wilson and Cindy Birdsong. But then Linda and I and Gene came together in 1986 when we formed the former Ladies of the Supremes. And we sang, actually, it was Gene, myself, and Cindy Birdsong. But Cindy only stayed a few months, and then she left to do some evangelizing. And so Gene said, let me call up Linda. So Linda came in. And so we started touring and singing for a few years. And then Gene left at, I think, 1996, something like that. And anyway, we got a couple other replacements, Linda's sister, Sundray Tucker, and then Freddie Poole, who now sings with the Three Degrees. And Joyce Vincent came in, was it 2009? And Joyce and I have been friends since 1968 at Invictus Records, when she and her sister Pam Vincent, along with Thelma Hopkins, were singing backups for all the acts there. And so Joyce is like family. And in fact, we go call ourselves play cousins. But so we've been together. Suse came in and sang with us for a few years, then Suse just went to be on her own. So Linda stepped back in, because Linda retired, I think, in 2017. And that's when Suse came in. And so now Suse is going on doing her solo work, which she does so beautifully. And Linda came back in earlier this year, back in, I think, May or something like that. And we've been touring, and this Sherry, Linda, formerly of the Supremes, with Joyce Vincent. And we just have a great time. We're always laughing and having a good time, and it's just been wonderful.
That's fantastic.
And so Friday's going to be so much fun, so much fun. I have cousins coming in, my cousins Sterling and Lisa Owens from Sacramento, my cousins who live there in Oakland, Ann Willis and Henry D. Williams from Afar Creations. We're just going to have a great time.
Well, if you're trying to catch that show and you don't want to miss the good times, you can find tickets to Former Ladies of the Supremes with Sherry Payne at marinjazz.com. That's marinjazz.com. Thank you so much for speaking to me. This is a wild dream come true. And you're fantastic. Your voice is fantastic. I hope that you have a fabulous show.
Oh, thank you so much. I had a great time chatting with you guys. Have a great day, a blessed day. And come on out on Friday, guys. We're going to have a lot of fun with Ron Asley, our MD. Hey.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shejo. Let's wallow. And Sherry, have a wonderful concert Friday. She's singing some Sondheim here, one of my favorites, a cover of Losing My Mind.
The morning ends, I think about you. I talk to friends, and I think about you. And do they know it's like I'm losing?
Still to come, the Nutcracker at the San Francisco Ballet, kosher comedy in a Chinese restaurant on Christmas. That's coming up as well. Stay with us here on The Arts. I'm David Latulipa. Thanks again to Shejo Letswala.
Thank you all so much. Thank you, Sherry.
King to see ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum.
Well, that unlikely combination of Bing Crosby and David Bowie no doubt takes you back. You're invited to celebrate two legends, one of them Bowie, with their musical and visuals all night. DJs playing all David Bowie and Elvis Presley. This year, the Bash celebrates the 90th anniversary of Elvis's birth and the 50th anniversary of David Bowie's Plastic Soul album, Young Americans. It's been an annual event which began in 2011 in San Francisco and was co-founded by my guest, Steve Indig, also known as DJ Shindog. Happy that Steve is taking some time to be with us today to tell us more about that Bash and a couple of others. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Hey, so take us back to the first idea of doing these two birthday boys together.
Well, I'll have to admit it was somebody else's idea. A friend of mine named Spig that ran a store called Costume Party, and he did a lot of event. He sort of collaborated on events that had to do with like older styles because he had this like the retro store. But David Bowie and Elvis Presley have the same birthday on January 8th. And actually, until he approached me about this, I didn't even realize that. But I, you know, am a DJ and a promoter. And so we collaborated together to do this for quite a number of years, originally at the Edinburgh Castle Pub, which was a lot of fun. Even if people are like kind of casual fans of either artist, they really get into it. And then people that are hardcore fans of either artist are totally into it. So I've always had a lot of fun with this now for over the last, whatever it's been, like 14 years, although we skipped like a year during the pandemic.
Well, it's hard to believe it's been 50 years since Young Americans came out.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you know, that, as I think maybe you mentioned, so that was, Bowie called it himself his Plastic Soul album. And he recorded that at the Philadelphia studio that was associated with a lot of the soul music at the time, Sigma Sound, and worked with a lot of the soul musicians. And Luther Vandross, that was one of his earliest credits, was singing and co-writing and collaborating on that. And he even made an appearance on Soul Train, singing Young Americans, I believe.
Wow. Wow. And Bowie, just such a broad range of things, a true chameleon of the 20th century, that's for sure.
Well, that's kind of what he's called and known for, of being a chameleon in all his different styles, for sure. Both of these artists really died, you know, too young. I mean, Elvis very young at only 42.
Wow.
And even Bowie with cancer, he died at 69. And we had one of our event, you know, we always plan this event around their birthday. And Bowie had announced that he was releasing a new album on his birthday. The album Black Star came out on a Friday. We had a party on Saturday night that was great. And then Sunday, we all learned that he was gone. That was a very intense time.
Wow. And then tell us about your equal, or maybe it's not equal, fascination with Elvis.
No, I have a big fascination with both of them, really. I mean, I love early rock and roll. In the last couple years, I've read the two-part Elvis biography by Peter Guralnick, which is like very eye-opening. And I've, you know, soaked in a lot of the Elvis media. I'm definitely a big fan of Elvis Sun Studio. Also a big appreciation for his comeback in 1968, which started with that TV show and a number of recordings that were kind of overlapping with a sort of Southern soul style at the time. So I have a big appreciation for Elvis. I have long sideburns, and sometimes people say I look like Elvis, so can't get away from it.
Well, as a DJ, are you still spinning and mixing on vinyl?
Yes, and it goes back and forth depending on my event. This event, myself and my co-DJ will definitely have records. My co-DJ on this is Cammy Blackstone, who's also been a radio personality and is a well-known figure around San Francisco. But she's a huge Elvis fan, and of course, as a music fan, she's a David Bowie fan. So we've collaborated on this, and we'll both have records that night. Yep, from our collection.
Nice, nice. It's the Bowie and Elvis Birthday Bash 2025 edition, Saturday, January 4th. 4 days before that birthday of those boys, 1 day before my birthday on the 5th.
Wow.
it's going to be at the Riptide 3639 Taravelle near 47th Ave out in the Aves here in San Francisco. Prior to that, though, Steve, one other interesting thing, at least, a New Wave City New Wave Winter Ball is set for this coming Saturday.
Oh, you noticed that. Yeah. Okay. So that's sort of the event that I'm kind of really known for. New Wave City is a monthly 80s, alternative 80s, new wave DJ dance party. Now I've done it for 33 years. So that is a week from, no, it's not this Saturday. Yeah, this Saturday. Yeah, the 21st. You caught me off guard.
Well, I hope you show up.
Yeah, so we call it, in December, we call it the Winter Ball. We're collecting toys. We have some decorations and some like winter and Christmassy theme stuff, but it's a DJ party focused on the alternative 80s new wave era. So that's really the home of DJ Shindog.
And that's going to be this Saturday at the Cat Club on Folsom Street. We'll have links at our website as well. And then after the Bowie Elvis Bash on the 18th of January, you've got something else coming up.
Well, yeah, you're meeting everything. Oh, wait a minute. The 18th of January. Well, that's the next New Wave City, right?
Yeah, well, that's a salute to Bukesh Mode on the 18th.
I thought maybe you noticed I'm actually also DJing at the Flame and Groovies concert on the now that's the 11th at the Chapel. That's the focus on them, and I'm just kind of in between the bands. But yeah, so the following New Wave City, the 18th, is another set in our monthly events. It's every third Saturday. And I got to say one thing about that is we have a special guest DJ that's DJing for the first time in any public setting. She's going by DJ Black Pearl. And it's a young lady that is going to be 3 days past her 21st birthday. And that's my daughter.
Oh, neat. That'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking some time, Steve. We'll have those links
at our
website, and enjoy the holidays.
All right. You too. And happy birthday.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
All right, take care.
Here's a little Bowie for us to get into our next segment.
Slinky back up on because as it passes on.
A little David Bowie for you to get you in the mood for the Elvis David Bowie Bash 2025 edition. Still to come, Kung Pao kosher comedy, Jewish comedy on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant. I'll talk with Matt Kirshen, comedian as part of the lineup, and the creator of that program, Lisa Geduldig. That's coming up here on KLW's On the Arts. The memorable sound of the magical celeste and the epitome of holiday music, the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker. A composer whose, let's say, sexual orientation is no doubt trumpeted by Vladimir Putin as Russia's greatest gay export. Or maybe not so much, but we know better, and Vlad should as well. It's a holiday time. It does mean the Nutcracker Ballet first premiered in Russia in 1892 and didn't have any performances outside of Russia until 1934, and in the home country of my guest, conductor Martin West, England. One of the most performed ballets of all time. It's difficult to get that music out of your head this time of year, wherever in the world you may roam. Martin West is acknowledged as one of the foremost conductors of ballet, who next year celebrates 20 years with the SF Ballet. He was born in Bolton, England, studied math at Cambridge University before studying at the St. Petersburg Conservatory of Music and London's Royal Academy. He's expanded the profile of the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra with a number of critically acclaimed recordings, including the complete score of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker back in 1988, that excerpt from there, and an album of suites from Delibes, Sylvia, and Coppelia. In addition, he conducted on the award-winning DVD of Neumeier's The Little Mermaid, as well as SF Ballet's production of Nutcracker for PBS. Always a pleasure to welcome you back, Martin West.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Of course. Although I think we need a correction in your bio, or maybe just for the programs that are printed in Great Britain. I mentioned you study math.
I did all of them. I did all of them.
That's what your major would have been, maths. Is that correct?
Mathematics, I suppose.
I get it now. Okay. Well, let's talk about that. First, about the marathon training that you must go through to get through a season of as many performances of the Nutcracker that the San Francisco Ballet does each year. Have you got a special belt that you notch off each one you've conducted? Where are you up to?
That's a very good question. I used to count them, you know, so I knew where I was, but I realized it doesn't help. So every show is its own entity, and it's the most important show I've ever done. So that's now I have a different attitude, I suppose. I mean, maybe 10 years ago, I was wondering about that. But then I always wondered what it'd be like to have a year off Nutcracker. And then the pandemic happened, and I realized it wasn't so great. So I really look forward to it every year.
Yeah.
We have lots of performances this year.
I was going to say, something you do to make sure you're healthy and alert for all of these performances? I just mentioned off the air that we lost one of the members to COVID.
Yeah, unfortunately, I lost a couple of them actually, but that's just a hazard of the trade at the moment. I try and keep myself fit. I do a lot of swimming on the off season, so I've got some muscle strength for when I get in there. And I have a fantastic orchestra, and so actually conducting them is really easy nowadays. I don't have to give very much, and they just play wonderfully.
Well, I think it was another frequent flyer here on the arts that conducted last night, Ming Luke. How do you divide up the duties, especially on doubleheader days? Do you take a matinee in an evening, or do you share?
Yeah, something like that. I tend to do about half of them myself, and I have guests to do the rest of them. Mm-hmm. It's a nice way of getting people into the company who we haven't seen before, give them a chance, see what they can do. Mm-hmm. But I try and do quite a lot at the beginning to make sure everything is all set. And then so by the end of the run, I'm only doing maybe one every couple of days or one out of every three shows.
Hmm.
There's no exact science to it, though.
Yeah. I mentioned that the first complete performance outside of Russia took place in England in 1934, but we have reason to be proud here in San Francisco, as the ballet's first complete U.S. performance was on the 24th of December, 1944, by, drumroll please, the San Francisco Ballet in this very opera house.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we set the tradition, really. It was barely played. Even in England, it still wasn't barely played in those days. And somehow, what we did, and what they did, I suppose, I should say, in 1944, just really set the scene, and everybody took it off. And of course, I don't know how many different Nutcrackers there are in the world. In America, there are nowadays. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
It is. This is Helgi's version, set in 1915 San Francisco, and celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. Helgi Thomason, artistic director of the ballet from 1985 to 2022. Tell us a little bit about the different versions of Nutcracker that you've witnessed.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Helgi's is probably one of my favorites, actually, set in San Francisco, and seems to have just a great feel to it every year. It always seems fresh. I've done ones which were set in different cities. I've done one which was very traditional in the Royal Ballet, set right back in Germany, like it was originally set. I did one, I think the first one I did was set in a very modern era, where all the dancers, it was back in the late 90s, and everybody had mobile phones while they were dancing. It's quite funny. But the thing is, if it dates, if you do things that are dated, then they don't last. I think that's why Helgi's has lasted so long, that it's just kind of timeless, really.
Do you ever see Mark Morris's version, The Hard Nut?
I have seen that as well. That's funny. Yeah,
it's interesting. I thought it was just kind of a joke of a parody of the Nutcracker, but it actually is based on a long flashback story within the main plot titled The Tale of the Hard Nut. That was Hoffman's original.
He's a very clever man, Mark. And then every year he updates his choreography as well. I remember going to see it when the Gangnam Style was all the rage, and he was dancing in the background. A funny man.
He's a lot of fun. I interviewed him a couple times. The original choreographer gave Tchaikovsky some extremely detailed instructions for the composition of each number, down to the tempo and the number of bars. And the completion of the work was interrupted for a short time when Tchaikovsky came to visit the United States and attend and conduct concerts for the opening of Carnegie Hall. Now, given that the choreography has to be so precisely timed, how much wiggle room do you have? I mean, we all have heard different versions of the Waltz of the Flowers, where it's bum, bum, the ending goes bum, 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 bum. But I'm bum, bum, bum. Can you take that kind of a liberty, or does it always have to be the same every night?
You can a little bit. Helgi's choreography does have some leeway into it, which is great. There's a sort of a, what would you call it? It's like a good line which you can take, and which you can veer off a little bit here and there to make things interesting. Every show is different. We have a little thing between our conductors. We try and aim for a certain time for the first act, so that to keep ourselves consistent, so we have a good sense of our own internal tempo. I mean, the old ballet is different, and all the dancers are different. They all want their different things that they want to try and do when they're dancing, certain show off their tricks. So it's every night is different. You know, you could see it three times, and it would be different each time.
And of course, the ballet company itself has to have a long bench too, in case of injury or illness.
It's a fantastic way of having all, you know, lots of dancers having a good chance to have a really good chance to show themselves at the beginning of the season as well. You know, we've had sort of 6 months without hardly any dancing because of our season. So to come into Nutcracker and have 37 shows, and there's still plenty to go, to have them have a chance to do all these roles, it gets them into shape really for our season that's coming up.
Well, here's some fun facts about the San Francisco production. The Snow Queen's embellished tutu took 80 hours to make, and they have five of them, so you do the maths. That's some 400 hours creating just one costume. I think the budget for costuming has increased just a bit. The very first production had 143 costumes, which, including labor and materials, you tell me how much.
Is it, what, in 1944?
Yeah.
Oh, probably nothing, was it?
$1,000.
$1,000, amazing. You won't get much for that nowadays.
I think the musicians were a little lesser paid as well.
That's incredible. Yeah.
And let's see, so much snow. Is that snow reused? Is it like a fresh batch each night? Or
no, it's definitely used. It's one of the great sights, actually. I wish all the audience could see this.
Yeah.
As soon as the curtain comes in, a team of about 10 or maybe even 20 of the crew get on stage with huge brooms, and they're just shoveling it all back into these big bins, and they take them back stage. And then there's a sort of a giant sieve, which they make sure nothing has been swept up, so that it falls down from a great height, so you
right.
don't have anything that's not the paper. So they sieve it all through, and everything gets recycled every time. So but it's a great sight to see them do it. It's amazing how quickly they can do it.
What is the material that they use?
Do you know? It's a kind of a paper, kind of a confetti paper.
So it's got to be somewhat slip-proof, or have you seen some mishaps of people slipping on the ice?
I shouldn't say that. There have been one or two people slipped on the ice, but as time goes on, people are very clever about where they're standing and things like that. No, we haven't had these so far this season. Touch wood. We won't have any this year. So.
Yeah, indeed. Well, here's another piece of trivia for you. You know the famous scene in The Wizard of Oz where when it snows, so they wake up from the poppy in the poppy patch, and the snow goes all over them and all over the field. Do you know what that snow was made of?
I don't.
Asbestos.
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh. But the Tin Man was painted with silver, wasn't he?
Original Tin Man was Buddy Ebsen, and he had such a reaction to the paint that they had to find a replacement.
You know, our snow gets everywhere because there's so much of it. You can find it in the Opera House throughout the year. If you ever need to see snow, you can see it. My dressing room, I just can't get rid of it. No matter how many times I clean it, there's always, it appears out of the woodwork somehow.
Indeed. well, let's hope for no mishaps, of course, and continued health with the rest of the company. The music, as everyone knows, it is quite memorable. And I think the Pas de Deux is, of course, incredible for what I think is one of the most incredible, simple, beautiful descending scales ever written.
It's incredible. You know, he had a hard time thinking of what to do, and there's lots of theories, but people, if you look at the rhythm of the words, it mirrors one of the lines of the Vespers, and his sister, I think, had died not long before. And people think it's, even though it's in a G major scale, ostensibly a nice happy tune, it has a real sense of poignancy and sort of inner sadness to it for me. It's incredible. It's a simple scale, and it's one of the most incredible pieces of music I've ever written.
We'll go out with that in a moment. You're going to have a 20th anniversary of yourself next year with the company.
Yeah, I can't believe it's come up so soon, actually. I mean, I thought I'd be here for a couple of years, but I managed to last it out so far. We're looking forward to a great season coming up. Tomorrow's picked a wonderful program for me and the orchestra. We've got Manon coming up early in end of January.
End of January, yeah. So you'll be rehearsing pretty straight on after the Nutcracker. And I know you're very
excited. I'll have a week off, and then we'll come back and start rehearsing all that.
Wow. I know you're very excited about that because apparently it was, your first ballet score back in San Francisco in the 90s? Or
No, actually, it was back in England. Just as I left college, and I'd never seen a ballet. I knew nothing about ballet. And the Royal Ballet rang me up and said they needed someone to rehearse an orchestra in Palermo in Italy, because they were on tour and they'd run out of conductors. And so I went and rehearsed this ballet for 2 weeks. I had a wonderful time. And I never got to do the ballet. So this has been my first time actually conducting it for the ballet itself. So 30 years later, it's going to be a real treat. It's really one of the great masterpieces of the ballet.
Well, you know, Jules Massenet's Manon, I always think of in an operatic stage.
Yeah, it is an opera, yeah. And this has none of the music from the opera.
It doesn't? Wow.
No, not at all. It's all... Massenet wrote loads of music, and a lot of it is just orchestral music, which was really well put together by this man, Leighton Lucas, back in the 60s. There's some songs as well, not from the opera, but from different places, different operas, or just songs, and he orchestrated those. And it's what's amazing about Manon is that you could listen to it and think it was written as a full ballet score. It's really clever.
Well, your colleagues in the British press were not very kind at the 1974 premiere. This is what one said in The Guardian. Basically, Manon is a slut and Degria is a fool, and they move in the most unsavory company. Well,
well, that's maybe the story, but the ballet isn't like that. So it did take a little while, I know, but I think since then people have realized actually it's probably Macmillan's masterpiece. So I think people should come and judge it for themselves. I wouldn't be too worried about what they said in 1974.
The opening night audience did give the ballet a standing ovation in spite of the Morning Star calling the ballet an appalling waste of the lovely Antoinette Sibley, who as Manon is reduced to a nasty little diamond digger.
I was very lucky. When I started working in ballet, I actually worked with David Wall, who was the original, was he the original Degria, I think, or was he, or Lesko, I can't remember. He was one of the two. They used to trade it off with Anthony Dowell, and it was fantastic talking to him about it back in the day.
Well, we'll have to have you on to talk more about the Manon score in the month of January.
Yeah, that'd be great, yeah.
In the meantime, you have 19 more opportunities to catch the Nutcracker here in San Francisco as part of the San Francisco Ballet's amazing Helgi Thomasson production, complete with a dancing bear, a music box ballerina come to life, tiny tots dancing as ladybugs, and a lot of snow, including tonight, 19 more opportunities, sfballet.org, through Sunday, the 29th of the month. Martin, as always, thanks so much. We're going to go out with some of that beautiful pas de deux music that you recorded back in 1988. Cheers. That's definitely not the Nutcracker you'll hear on the San Francisco Ballet stage, and I don't think you'll hear that klezmer version anywhere in the Bay Area, but as a nice segue, Kung Pao Kosher Comedy is celebrating its 32nd annual Jewish Comedy on Christmas in a Chinese Restaurant Extravaganza, December 24th to 26th of this month. The San Francisco Institution returns to San Francisco's Chinatown this year to its new home, the Imperial Palace Restaurant, just steps away from the new Chinatown Rose Pack Muni Station. What's on the menu, you ask? Well, it's a course of 3 days with two shows a day, family-style seating of tables of 10, affectionately named after prominent Jewish folk like Barbara Streisand. Oh my gosh, she's like butter. Jackie Mace and Joan Rivers, you get the idea. It's the brainchild of Lisa Geduldig, who created Kung Pao Kosher Comedy in 1993, sort of by accident. We'll let her tell that story. But a little bit more about Lisa. She is San Francisco-based and the creator of Kung Pao Kosher Comedy. Pre-pandemic, Lisa had been running Comedy Returns to El Rio, a monthly decade-long comedy show at El Rio in San Francisco, where her comedy career began some 30-plus years ago. From July of 2020 until September of 2024. Lisa produced the monthly lockdown comedy on Zoom from the underwear drawer in the guest room at her mother's retirement community home in Florida, where she accidentally got marooned. Lisa appeared in a Canadian documentary, Dreaming of a Jewish Christmas, which aired on Canadian and European TV in December back in 2017. She's also a freelance arts publicist in both English and Spanish. Lisa, it's always a pleasure to welcome you back and to tell us a little bit more about that storied history of Kung Pao.
Thanks for having me, David. It's so interesting to listen to someone else telling the story. Like, oh, yeah, sounds interesting from that perspective. Well, it was October 1993, and I was booked to perform at a women's comedy night in Massachusetts in South Hadley, outside of Northampton. And it was at the Peking Garden Club, and I thought it was going to be a comedy club, and I got there, and it was a Chinese restaurant. And a conversation with an old friend from summer camp the next day led to the joke of an idea of doing a Jewish comedy night on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant. Came back to San Francisco from this trip, couldn't get it out of my mind, and wrote a press release, tried to find a Chinese restaurant, tried to explain Jews and Chinese food and Christmas to the banquet managers, and hired some comedians and thought it was going to be a one-off. And we sold out and turned a couple of hundred people away and kept doing it. And now it's 32 years.
That's amazing. And it always is a benefit. And who are this year's beneficiaries?
This year, we're giving partial proceeds to the Chinatown YMCA Food Pantry, as well as Shalom Bayit, which is a Jewish domestic violence organization in the Bay Area.
We have very fortunate to have one of your comedians that is part of the lineup here, Matt Kirshen. Before we talk with him, let's hear a little bit of his bit on something that is one of my pet peeves as well, something about drivers.
I know, you live in a strange country. You should realize that. You should know that about yourselves. You're good people, you're friendly people, but you have an edge. Particularly Midwest as well. You're a strange bunch of people. Because honestly, even compared to America, you are some of the friendliest people you could ever hope to meet. Until you get into a car. And then I do not know what happens to you, but something changes. You guys are just horrible. You are some of the most vicious drivers I have ever met in my life. I do not know. You just turn into monsters. I've driven once in the Midwest and once only. I will never do it again. I was on a 3-lane highway and I needed to change lanes and I made the mistake of signaling. Yeah, I know now. Because anywhere else in the world, that's the procedure. I don't know if you know that. That's what those lights are for, basically. The way it generally works is you flick those left or right, and then people around you know that you're gonna try and move left or right, and they make a little bit of a space for you, and you get into that space, and then everyone carries on with their lives.
That's a touch of Matt Kirshen, whose precision wit has earned him an impressive reputation on the international comedy circuit. Started his comedy career in the UK, then moved to America as a finalist on NBC's Last Comic Standing. He's also appeared on Comedy Central's At Midnight, Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, among others. Continuing a nerdy narrative, he is one of the regular guest co-hosts of Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson. In addition, he also hosts Probably Science, a weekly comedy and science podcast featuring a mix of comedians and scientists breaking down the week's science news. Welcome to you, Matt.
Oh, David, thanks so much. That clip that you just dug, you dug that out from a while, but I was while you were playing that, I was about to pull you up and I go, oh, that was some ages ago. I can't even remember it. And then I remembered that earlier on the show you had a Supreme here talking about her songs from the 70s. And then suddenly that doesn't feel so, oh wow, look, how did you manage to pull out that one from 2008? Remember 2008 when we didn't even have Wi-Fi back then. We had to use hardwired broadband. That's how long ago it was.
Well, I think your voice is matured a little bit more too since then.
I think maybe it has. Maybe a decade and a half of living in polluted Los Angeles has added up.
Well, you're kind of lucky you weren't in Los Angeles in the more polluted 70s. That's for sure. Yeah,
that's true. That is true.
Matt, first of all, tell me about your family and their reaction to your taking what maybe could have been a career in science and instead becoming a comedian.
Oh, I think actually, oddly enough, you have two guests in a row who have Cambridge mathematics degrees. This shouldn't happen. I don't know what the odds are of that, but. and then both who went into the arts.
That's wild. The, Martin West, my former guest, the guest you just said, the conductor of the San Francisco
Martin,
Ballet.
Martin, the conductor of the ballet, he went into the higher arts and I went into the, let's say, less savory ones. But
you're both having fun. That's what counts.
We are both having fun. And I would say, as far as my parents, as far as anyone who knew me at university would, I don't think would have thought that the sciences were my natural path. I don't think any of my professors, my supervisors, I think when I started doing stand-up comedy, I think a lot of them were relieved, if nothing else, because I would have probably set the course of research back.
Matt, Lisa, how did you first come across Matt?
I came across him from Last Comic Standing, and then I went to the Punchline and saw him, and then I hounded him for about 10 years to try and get him to do Kung Pao, and he was always going home to England for Christmas, and then luckily he married someone here and now he stays. And during the pandemic, when I was doing lockdown comedy, everyone was available for comedy shows, every single comedian. I was like, are you available? Yes. So Matt did some lockdown comedy shows, and then I convinced him to do Kung Pao since he's not going home to England.
We should also,
yeah, you did that. Those gigs were, I mean, they were wonderful gigs anyway. They were fun, but also they were sanity savers for comics, I think. Just comics and audience alike. But it was, I don't know if you, I'm sure you've met a few comics in your time, but we tend to get a little tetchy, a little edgy if we don't get up on stage for a while. And having those online gigs really helped out. That was good. And Lisa was running some of the best.
Luckily, the pandemic happened when it did, because we were able to see all this amazing entertainment. I watched Dionne Warwick in her living room during a concert.
Wow.
Couldn't have done that.
Yeah. It's the 32nd annual Kung Pao Kosher Comedy Special, Jewish comedy on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant. You can learn more at koshercomedy.com. Matt, looking forward to hearing more of your more recent bits, shall we say. And Lisa, always a pleasure to have you on, and we'll have to have you on again as well for whatever else is coming in the new year. I wish you health and happiness.
Thank you.
Let's go out with a little Christmas time for the Jews, as you requested. This has been On the Arts. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks again to Lisa and Matt for taking the time.
They disappear one day each year and pass the eggnog round. But it's all right, 'cause that's the night the Jews control the town.
That's On the Arts for this week. My thanks to Janice Lee for producing the show. A couple of weeks of hiatus. Next week, being Christmas, we're going to have a special from PRX, some holiday music for you. And then what's become a tradition the past couple of years on the, let's see, it's going to be the 7th day of Christmas, Amal and the Night Visitors, a broadcast of one of the fine recordings on January 1st. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks so much for listening. We're archived at klw.org.